Our second case this morning is Field versus AC Services in the Department of Employment and Economic Development, A21-0227. As all parties are aware, this matter is being conducted on Zoom. We are recording it. There will be a opportunity, I think, tomorrow for everyone who wants to, you know, hear what they said, to go listen to it. But our rules do prohibit anyone from doing their own recording, either counsel or anyone who is listening to this, on video. So with that, we will get started. Counsel for the respondent, for the appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your argument in chief. Counsel for the respondent, you will have 15 minutes, and then finally the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So counsel for relator, whenever you are ready, just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Ashley Tronson of Frederickson and Byron on behalf of employee relator, Mr. Dennis Field. And we are here today to ask the court to reverse the unemployment law judge's underlying denial of benefits to Mr. Field, of unemployment benefits. And that is justified for two reasons. First, Mr. Field is eligible for unemployment law benefits under the statute, as he was neither discharged for employment misconduct nor aggravated employment misconduct. And second, the underlying decision to deny benefits was both legally incorrect and factually unsupported by the record. So going to the
Before you get started, you raise a number of different arguments in your brief, and I know we have limited time to talk about them today. So if you could describe for me the strongest argument for reversal.
Yeah, I would say the strongest argument is that it is just legally incorrect. So under the statute, it defines employment, well, I guess taking a step back, in order to not be eligible for benefits, Mr. Field would have had to have been terminated for employment misconduct. And employment misconduct is defined as intentional, negligent, or indifferent conduct that is a serious violation of the standards of behavior of the employer that it has a reasonable right to expect of the employee. And here that just isn't the case. And I think
setting aside the facts, I know we're going to get to the facts because I know you have a number of challenges to the ULJ's findings of fact. But as a general proposition, do you agree that an employee who is insubordinate on maybe two occasions has committed employment misconduct?
I think it depends upon the facts, quite honestly. So I think, yes, under the court's precedent, there certainly is room for insubordination and insubordination being employment misconduct. But the facts are key as to whether or not something actually was insubordinate and whether it was, in fact, of a level that was so serious that rises to the level of employment misconduct. You know, we're not arguing here over whether KC Services was able to terminate Mr. Field. You know, certainly that was their prerogative. What we are deciding here is whether the facts then make him ineligible for unemployment benefits, which is a much higher standard under the law. So to answer your question, in certain circumstances, yes, absolutely, insubordination can and likely is misconduct. Here, I don't think there was insubordination, and I don't think it rises to the level of misconduct.
And on that issue, Ms. Tronson, is that because, at least on the first issue, it wasn't insubordination because he was friends with the guy and, no harm, no foul?
I think that's relevant. Certainly, you can still be insubordinate even if you are friends. My larger point of that is context matters. And here, that is a part of the context. Mr. Field did have this longstanding relationship with his supervisor and did, felt comfortable challenging things if he was wondering whether it was the most appropriate course of action. But certainly the record is clear that even in instances where he might question a particular policy or course of action, he always complied with a direct order to do something.
I want to ask you something about the record. It's my understanding that when he, on April 13th, when Mr. Fields responded to Mr. Cordes's text message about you can't order the gas before you start your shift, that the response went to not only Mr. Cordes, but the other employee, who that it was part of this text chain. Is that true?
I think if it was part of a text chain, yes, that would be true. I don't have.
So does that make a difference in terms of the context? If it was communication just with somebody who's been his friend, but now you have another employee who committed the, you know, committed the same violation of the new policy. Doesn't that make a difference that he included the other employee in that text?
I think it would make a difference if he was including others who weren't a part of this conversation. But if this was an ongoing conversation between three employees and Mr. Fields' response was, well, I don't understand, and I realize I'm paraphrasing, but I don't understand what is the problem with ordering loads beforehand? We've always done it sort of thing. Then no, I don't think that gives rise to him to it being insubordination at that point. So back to Your Honor, Judge Connolly's question about, you know, context, you know, that is part of it. You know, there was this relationship, there was this understanding that they could talk freely amongst each other and really decide on what the best course of conduct can and should be. And also there is this context of this long-standing policy and practice of being able to do it, even when, you know, the company is saying, you know, we really don't want you to. That never really was enforced, and others continue to do it. So all of that put together, I think it was completely reasonable for Mr. Field to feel comfortable saying, you know, I don't understand. Is this really it? Are you really forcing us to do this? Why? What accounts for the change in heart? And in his testimony, he acknowledges what I expected was a call then from my supervisor explaining, okay, yeah, we're really getting pressure. We really do, you know, this is the way it is. But instead he got, you know, his supervisor turned around and suspended him for it. So there was no further discussion on it.
Ms. Johnson, go ahead, Judge Cochran. I think you had a question.
That's okay. I wanted to turn to the recording of the time off question. So go ahead if your question relates to the...
Yes, thank you. Great minds think alike. Ms. Tronson, so I want to make sure I understand, because I have to admit I'm a little confused. So if they call you, you get the $200, but if you call them, you take vacation or sick? I mean, is that it?
Right. And I think the point that you are confused and that the underlying unemployment law judge was confused and that it was clear in the record that the supervisor had gotten multiple calls of drivers who were confused all go to this point of, yes, Mr. Field was confused too. It was a confusing time. You have to remember this was March 2020. This was March, April 2020. This was when, you know, coronavirus had just hit the United States. Everything was shut down.
And I can appreciate that. But I mean, at the end of the day, he knew he was not getting the $200 and he still didn't put in for sick or vacation. Would that be a fair statement, Ms. Johnson?
It depends on when you're talking about. So the announcement of the policy actually came down sort of in the middle of when he was taking time off. So at the outset, that would not be a true statement because the policy wasn't fully formed or hadn't been fully announced at that point. And so at that time, when Mr. Field had started volunteering to take time off, the company was merely encouraging drivers, hey, we don't have any gas to haul. You know, if you want to take time off, take time off. And that's what Mr. Field did. He had a newborn at home. He thought, if I could stay home and keep my family safe, I will do that. And then in the middle of that week when he was taking time off, that's when this policy came down that said, okay, we still want people to take time off, but wait for us to call you. We're going to call you. We're going to decide based on seniority, I think, who should get the time off. And if we call you and you agree, we'll give you $200 as a way of, like, you know, offsetting that lost wage part.
Let me ask you this, Ms. Troenson. Accepting that your client was confused, and it sounds like lots of people were during the beginning of April, and it may in fact be that this finding of fact, I think it should have been April 7th when Casey's announced this kind of new policy. But what difference does that confusion make when the record indicates that your client was told by his admin on April 15th, so after the days he took off, and by his supervisor on April 17th, that he in fact needed to turn in those vacation days? So what does it matter that there was confusion on April 6th through the 9th when there's evidence in the record that your client was told twice later in the month that he needed to record those times?
All of that confusion helps inform the context of the situation of whether or not he would be paid for those days. And that is the framework of how he had approached this. So initially he took that time off thinking he was not getting paid. He thought it was unpaid time off because the company was saying, hey, if you want to take it off, you can take it off. And so the series of events is, this policy is announced. And so then he asked his supervisor, Mr. Field asked his supervisor, look, now there's this new policy that says I have to wait for you to call me. Am I still getting the $200? Am I still getting paid for this time off? Even though technically I called in first and then you called me, kind of what's happening? And the supervisor said, yeah, I think you still would qualify under the policy. Again, a confusing and ultimately untrue statement. And so Mr. Field wanted to confirm, okay, is that true? Am I going to get paid for these days? So that's why he reached out to his admin. Am I going to get paid for these days? And she said, you need to enter vacation time. And so Mr. Field testified very clearly and credibly, you know, he understood that to mean, in response to his question, am I going to get paid these days? Her response was, you need to enter vacation time. So he thought that meant, if I want to get paid for this time off, I need to enter vacation time to get paid, that I won't be getting the $200. And he thought, well, that's okay. I'll just take them unpaid. He didn't realize it was a choice between enter vacation time and get paid or get fired. He thought it was enter vacation time if I want to get paid or take them unpaid off. So it all leads to all of that confusion. And again, you know, when the supervisor reached out and said, you know, enter vacation time, that was his frame of mind. That was the context. That is how this situation came about, was questioning about whether he would get paid. So Mr.
Go ahead, Judge Cochran.
Just following up though, the unemployment law judge found that, you know, he had no reasonable basis to think he could take unapproved unpaid time off and not cover it with vacation or sick time based on the instructions that the company had given and then the instructions by the administrator that you just talked about and the further instructions from Mr. Cordes through, I believe, an email. I think you'd agree that we defer to the ULJ's credibility determinations. Is that correct?
Only if the standard for deferring to credibility is met, and which means that credibility determinations must be supported by a valid reason for crediting a testimony and supported by the substantial evidence. And here, I don't think either of those apply, quite honestly.
Well, isn't there evidence from the company that they had this policy that you either had to take vacation time or sick time to cover time off, as well as evidence that, and I think you would agree that these, you know, that his administrator told him he needed to enter at the time, and then Mr. Cordes basically said the same thing. So given that, I mean, it's not our role to reweigh the evidence. So what basis is there for us to conclude that, you know, to not defer and conclude that that was clearly erroneous?
Two things. One, as to the credibility piece of things, You're right that I think one of the supervisors testified that that was the policy. Mr. Field also testified that in the past he had taken time off without using vacation time, that that was allowed. So you're right, that kind of goes back to the credibility piece of things. The second part of that, the credibility part, is that the ULJ's determination and decision didn't say, you know, what she believed and what she didn't believe. She just generally said, I believe the supervisors over Mr. Field when it conflicts, because they are more convincing. And when it came down to, did Mr. Field reasonably, or did he misunderstand? Did he genuinely misunderstand what was happening and that he was required to enter the vacation time? The conflicting evidence there is the supervisors basically said, well, he couldn't have misunderstood because it was clear. Like, that doesn't go to whether or not Mr. Field actually did, and ignores all of the context piece of things. As to the other part that you mentioned about, you know, then what grounds do you have? So I do think there's a credibility issue. I do think there is lack of substantial evidence, but also it is legally erroneous, and it is a legal determination as to whether something is misconduct. And so I can pick up on that. I see my time is up. I can pick up on that on the rebuttal, unless you want me to finish answering the question now.
I think you've answered the question, Ms. Johnson. Thank you. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Okay. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Phillips, and I represent Respondent Department of Employment and Economic Development, or DEED. So I'll start with kind of the last thing you were talking about, the issue of the vacation time. So the ULJ found that relator's actions were insubordinate and a knowing violation of policy versus relator's assertion that he misunderstood. The ULJ made a credibility determination and also made some specific findings that support this overall finding that it was a knowing violation. And I'll talk about some of the findings that support that. So the ULJ made a finding that Casey's had this policy, that drivers have to use vacation or sick time for days off. Relator admitted that he knew that policy. The ULJ found that on March 28th, Casey's communicated to the fleet that due to a work shortage, they could take time off, but they had to use vacation or sick time to cover that time off. The ULJ further found that this was communicated by electronic messages, and that relator received or should have received those messages. The ULJ found that on April 15th, the administrator sent relator this email stating, you will need to enter sick or vacation time for those days. And if you have any questions, call your supervisor. The ULJ found that 2 days later, relator's supervisor sent him a text message saying, Dennis, just a reminder, dates from 4-6 to 4-9, you need to turn in time for. This has to be done before the end of the pay period. So those were read into the record, and that's the language that was used. So, you know, relator testified that he assumed, he used the word assumed, he could take these unpaid days because of what was going on at the time. So if he was confused when he took those days off, which may be understandable, this confusion was cleared up when the administrator specifically told him he needed to enter time off for those days. And she even referred him to his supervisor with questions. So at this point, he should have called his supervisor to clarify this. If that kind of disabused him of his assumption that he could take those days as unpaid.
Ms. Phillips, I understand your argument. I just want to stop you. Unlike many cases that come before us on appeal from ULJ's decisions, I think in this case, DEED has acknowledged that there are some findings of fact that are not supported by the evidence, including one aspect of the credibility findings. As I recall, there's a general credibility finding, and then the ULJ goes on to explain this series of close events that ULJ construed to indicate insubordination rather than the confusion. But one of them was this calling in as a volunteer instead of waiting to be called or asked. And you acknowledged in your brief that that is not supported by the evidence. And I appreciate that we won't call it a concession, but that acknowledgement. But what doesn't that undermine the credibility findings to such an extent that we would need to reverse or at least remand for further discussion of credibility?
No, it doesn't impact the credibility determination to that extent of reversal, because there is still a series of events that were insubordinate. And that language about the series is actually language from the employer's witnesses in the hearing. You know, they said several times, we discharged him because of this series of insubordinate events. And the series that of events that is supported by the record include the following things. The fact that Relator was calling in early for his load after being told not to do that. There's testimony that he did that a number of times after this new policy was implemented. Then we have the incident when his supervisor says, hey, you need to follow this policy. And he responds, and I wouldn't characterize it as by questioning about the policy. He responds in a rude way. He says, I will have to get the text up, but something to the effect, what the hell is the difference? Why can't we ask for a load at 4:30? So it's not a genuine conversation about this policy. He doesn't want to do it. So the text is kind of confirmation that he's not following the policy because he doesn't like it or he doesn't think he should. The other part of the series of events is the fact that he did not enter his vacation time after the administrator asked him to do it, and he did not enter his vacation time after his supervisor told him to do it. So I would say there still is a series of insubordinate events. And this is what the employer used that language to explain why it was serious and why they discharged him. So the ULJ's credibility determination is based off of the employer's testimony about that series of events, but she does get a couple of the details wrong, I think. You know, she says that calling in as a volunteer instead of waiting to be called was insubordinate. I think the testimony is that was perhaps confusing and that was cleared up when on the 9th, when the supervisor said, you know, we don't want you to call in anymore. We'll call you. So I don't think that was insubordinate. But the rest of it is a series of insubordinate events. So I believe it does support the ULJ's credibility determination.
Ms. Phillips, it's been a while. Could you remind me what is the burden of proof that Deed has? Or actually, excuse me, the standard of proof. Is it preponderance or clear and convincing?
It's preponderance of the evidence. So there is no burden of proof. It is what evidence is more likely to be true than not. So in this case, the ULJ found that it was more likely to be true that the relator acted intentionally, that it was a knowing violation, than it was that it was a misunderstanding. So, and the evidence supports that finding, the evidence I just talked about. And I would also say that to characterize it as a misunderstanding is not quite accurate, because I believe the relator says that it was an assumption. He admits that nobody told him that he could take those days unpaid. And he admits that he knew there was a policy that he needed pre-approval. So I don't know that it was a misunderstanding so much as a confused assumption that he refused to address or clarify. And I think the conduct became insubordinate when he was getting those text messages and ignoring them. And if you look at the employer's testimony about it, they emphasize that he just ignored them. You know, they said, we didn't hear from him for a week and a half. He didn't respond to the administrator. He didn't respond to me. So if there was a genuine, confusion, or he really had this assumption, he needed to clear that up with his supervisor. He had just gotten a suspension for insubordination. He knew he was being held to some standards as far as following instructions. So he should have made that effort to clarify that. And so the employers testified that him ignoring them was insubordination that resulted in the discharge.
assuming we agree with you that, yeah, the evidence would support the ULJ's determination that this that the relator's conduct was intentional, not accidental. How do you respond to relator's argument that, okay, assuming all that is true, under all of the circumstances, in the context of what the world was going through in April of 2020, how are these really serious violations of the standards of behavior that the employer had a reasonable expectation of its employees?
So I think, I don't want to keep saying the same thing, but I think it becomes serious when he ignores the instructions, the direct instructions to him on two different occasions. And looking at the case law, Vargas, Schmigdahl, Daniels, the courts have held that a knowing violation of the employer's reasonable expectations is employment misconduct. It kind of wraps up that seriousness in the fact that it's an intentional violation or of a request or of a policy. So the seriousness comes in the fact that he intentionally violated a policy and a request. And then as the employer was asked, why is this so serious that you discharged him? And again, the employer said, because we saw a pattern. This all happened within 2 weeks, you know, in their eyes.
And Ms. Phillips, happening. I mean, just so that we're clear, I mean, you know, and these are my words, not yours. I mean, you know, there's patterns in RICO and then there's, you know, two instances. So, you know, we're talking about the first time was the text, right? And the second time is he didn't enter the time. Am I correct in assuming that the company did not lose money on the second incident, i.e., you know, they paid him for sick time he didn't take or, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, the company's not out of money, correct?
Correct. Yeah, there's no evidence that the company's out.
And then on the second one, and maybe it's me, but, you know, in this sort of back and forth on the sick leave, would it be a fair statement that, you know, it seemed like he's asking a question, they're responding by not asking the question, but by saying something again, and then he doesn't respond. First of all, would that be a fair characterization of the exchange between the HR, well, whoever is, you know, the timesheet guy and Ms. Johnson's client?
I think they answered his question. His question was, will I get paid the $200? And the answer to that question is, you need to enter vacation or sick time.
Right, but that's no, the answer to the question is yes or no. I mean, with all due respect, that's like everybody's lawyered up, you know. I mean, like, you know, I ask a question and then follow the policy. I mean, you know, following up on Judge Bjorkman's, the guy worked there for 7 years and, you know, I guess I have concerns, particularly, you know, with this isn't the greatest order we've ever seen, but it probably is the greatest brief or relator I've ever seen. Are we really, you know, is this really misconduct? I mean, based on not like, you know, I agree. If you don't, you know, there are policies, you don't fire them, you don't follow them, out you go, misconduct, no money. But here, I mean, there seems to be like, well, a back and forth here that seems, one could arguably, leaves some room for, you know, it's not so clear. And if it's not so clear, I mean, there are all those millions of cases that say, you know, the purpose of the unemployment statute is to compensate those who, you know, don't have their job, blah, blah, blah. So why wouldn't we just err on that, in favor of that, as opposed to following the line of cases that say, oh, you know, we told you to, you know, fill the five boxes in with a dark crayon and you didn't fill in the five boxes with a dark crayon, so out you go.
Okay. Well, I would just argue that the standard of review here is to look at the findings of fact and defer to them if supported by substantial evidence. And so there is conflicting evidence here that relator has pointed out, that the testimony of a misunderstanding. But the ULJ found that it was an intentional or a knowing violation. And I think if you look at the facts as they are written, I think that perhaps they could be construed as negligent. Here she found it was intentional, but I don't think you could find that it was inadvertent. If there was a misunderstanding, he was referred to his supervisor to clear it up. He knew what the expectation was. He didn't follow the request, and he didn't explain why he wasn't following the request. And this was after he had been suspended. So I think to answer your question, there is conflicting evidence here. It's a factual question. The ULJ, weighed the evidence and made findings of fact. Her facts are supported by substantial evidence. They're supported by the employer's testimony about the policies, about the communications, and so because it's supported, the court should affirm. The court shouldn't kind of reweigh and decide, maybe that is credible that he just misunderstood this, because that's not what the ULJ found here.
Ms. Phillips, can you just briefly address appellant's argument that the district court improperly excluded relevant evidence and that is a separate grounds for reversal?
Yes. So the evidence that's marked as exhibit number 4, which was not received, included the announcement of the $200, payment, as well as a copy of the suspension document. And both parties testified about both of these things. The record was developed. The record was developed on the $200 announcement. It was developed on the discipline for not calling in or calling in early for the loads. So Relator doesn't point to anything in these documents that wasn't already covered in the testimony. And he doesn't point to anything that would impact the decision. Again, I see my time is up. Can I finish answering my question?
Yes, please do.
Okay. I know there's a contention that the announcement was made on April 7th as opposed to April 2nd. The employer testified it was April 2nd. And I would just argue that this doesn't impact the decision because, again, the insubordination comes in when he's told to enter his time and he doesn't. So, when he's requesting these days off, there may have been some confusion, but that was cleared up after the fact. So there's nothing in those documents that wasn't already presented or that would impact the decision. There is no prejudice in not accepting those two documents. So the ULJ didn't abuse her discretion by declining to accept those. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Phillips. Ms. Johnson, you'll have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'd like to pick up on Judge Connolly's comments about standard of review and also looping back to that question that was last posed to me. And the answer to that is, under the law, whether a particular act constitutes disqualifying misconduct is a question of law, which the court reviews de novo. That's the Schmigdell case. So to all of your points, the court could say, okay, all of the facts as they are, we could take all the facts as they are, even the ones that are misconstrued and maybe not fully supported. And even all of that notwithstanding, this is not misconduct. In the context of the situation as a whole, not entering vacation time that causes no harm to the company, a single isolated incident of not entering this vacation time is not misconduct, especially like I said, with context matters in the context of all of this, that Mr. Field was employed there for 7 years, and now all of a sudden, two alleged incidences of subordination, which don't really rise to the level of, maybe they could be, maybe they couldn't be, but aren't straight out insubordination, does not rise to the level of misconduct in this instance. And then my second point I wanted to make is that, there are facts that were misstated. And yes, we can argue or assume or guess as to whether those facts were key to the unemployment law judge's finding. but we don't really know. And as I pointed out in the opening brief, there's quite a few of them that the unemployment law judge just gets wrong and goes to some of the key issues as to what was happening, what the policy was.
And what's the key unsupported finding of fact, or the key plural in your estimation?
Yeah, so there's a few of them. If I had to point out kind of the key, the top ones, I would say the communications surrounding the paid time off policy. Because number one, there is a question as to whether when that happened. And the unemployment law judge relied upon that to say that Mr. Field engaged in insubordination by calling in when in fact that wasn't true. So that's part of it. And then the other piece of things is the employer indicated that this communication indicated that they had to take time off or paid time off. And this goes to the question about whether or not there was error in not admitting that document into evidence. And if it's the document that I think it is, I don't think that announcement says that. So that goes both to error in not admitting evidence and to the credibility piece of things, because Mr. Field, I believe, testified that that wasn't part of the communication. And the document, if I'm recalling correctly, the document that Mr. Field tried to enter doesn't indicate that they had to take paid vacation at that time. So that's all to say it all goes to it not being fully supported and these conflicting credibility determinations that aren't supported by the evidence. And then one more piece of things as to context that I just want to point out, because there's been a few comments about how Mr. Field just ignored the text message. And I believe Mr. Field testified in the record that those messages came through on his day off. Certainly, I think that plays into the context of things, is that it wasn't, he was at work and he was being, you know, directly communicated to on work channels. It was, he was being texted on his day off. And as he testified, you know, about all the context relating to, he thought that they were saying something different than what they were, and that it was an entirely different conversation than what it was. So that all just goes
to clarify on that point. So the ULJ found that on April 15th, the administrator sent him an email stating that he needed to enter his vacation time. And on April 17th, Cordes sent a text message. So it was two separate days. And which of those days are you saying was on his day off?
The text message, the follow-up mm-hmm. response to the text message. So the email from his, that's from his administrative assistant. And I think that's another clarification that's important. This isn't, you know, a manager who, I think the ULJ frames it as, this is another manager who's ordering him to do it. No, this was his administrative assistant who he asked to follow up on this issue of whether or not he'd get the $200 payment. So I think that's another important piece of things.
Would you agree, though, Judge Conley? Can I just ask one quick follow-up?
Yes, please do, Judge Falcon.
Would you agree, though, that the record reflects that the pay period ended on April 20th?
Yes, I believe that is what the record reflects.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Ms. Phillips. Thank you very much, Ms. Johnson. I will be speaking for myself.